We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Roe v. Wade has been relegated to the ash heap of history where it belongs. I don't think we've ever come to a podcast with better news for our listeners. Roe v. Wade overturned in the Dobbs decision, which was written, the majority opinion was written as expected by Justice Samuel Alito. Justice Roberts did not join onto that opinion. He wrote he submitted a separate concurring opinion. David Harsanyi is joining us for this emergency edition of Federalist Radio Hour. I am holed up in a hotel room at a bed and breakfast in Vermont, where I'm right here for my friend's wedding. But David, I'm so glad you were able to take the time to talk about this decision. Does anything stand out to you now, having had about an hour to digest the news?
Not really. I mean, I think the meltdown we're seeing on the left was expected, though the leak actually, I think, helped maybe let people stew in it a bit and come to terms with what's going on. I just think it's great news. I think, you're just seeing a lot of people who have worked on this for years and years. I have to say, I've been writing about politics, I guess, for 20 years or so, maybe more. And I have to say, for probably 18 of those, I never would have imagined that this day could happen. And it has. So, I'm pretty excited, though. I will say, I think the hard work or more hard work begins for people who are pro-life starting today.
Explain what you mean by that. I mean, I've seen Senator Rubio already tossed a bill out there to support, or maybe even just the framework of a bill to support families, to support women in this early stage of family formation. And I know others have worked on it, and I know that's been certainly a goal of the pro-life movement, although, like you just mentioned, a lot of people did not expect this to ever happen. But what do you mean when you say it's going to get really hard for the pro-life movement?
Well, I think one aspect of it is helping women who are struggling with that situation now. As much as obviously, we're all pro-life and we believe the right decision is to have a baby and for the father to be responsible as well for that baby. It's tough, and we shouldn't treat it, we shouldn't be flippant about political or frivolous about political victories, et cetera. I mean, this is a serious topic and we should treat it that way. That's one part of it. So I haven't seen the Rubio bill, but obviously those kind of things I would support. But I think on the other hand, in the end, many years from now, long after I'm dead, I think we'll look back as a society and think of what we're doing now as, re-abortion as barbaric and immoral. And I think that that's going to take a lot of convincing. Now, you can pass a bunch of laws. I think that's important, especially when it comes, at least from my perspective, on late-term abortions and abortions of viable or near-viable unborn babies. But I think also in the end, you're going to have to convince lots of people that this is just immoral and barbaric. So I think that what I mean even deeper is that, for a long time now, for 50 years, the pro-abortion side of this debate has leaned on simply shutting it down and saying it's a constitutional right. So they haven't really had to, I think, make their case in the same way that the pro-life movement has. So I think that debate now, especially maybe not in deep blue states, but in other states, is going to occur. And I think that pro-life advocates need to be ready to make convincing, compelling moral arguments about why abortion's wrong.
All right. As I mentioned, I'm holed up in a bed and breakfast in Vermont, so you can hear the cleaning service vacuuming in the background. I guess that's always a good sign. But I'll just add, David, I wanted to ask you about this question of how we got here. I think, you're completely correct that for several decades, this was unthinkable. I think it was a helpful crutch for a lot of folks in the Republican establishment who wanted to give sort of a wink and a nod to the pro-life movement, but never fully embraced the ideas of the pro-life movement morally or politically. I think they see this as a political setback. I don't think they're with the pro-life movement morally. There are a lot of great people, pro-life people over at the RNC and in the Republican establishment. But not everybody is with the pro-life movement on this question. So how did we get here. After Casey, where you had Republican appointed justices going sort of against that side, we're now here with Dobbs. What happened, David?
Well, I mean, the history of it is, you know, the top three people we need to thank are Harry Reid for blowing up the judicial filibuster, for Mitch McConnell, and I think, you know, I know he gets a lot of flack from everyone and stuff like that on the right, but, or most people, but it was actually quite, I hate to use the word brave because obviously these people don't lose anything, but it was a huge political risk not to give Merrick Garland a hearing. At the time, there was tremendous pressure from a lot of people on the right, not just the left. So he deserves credit. And obviously Donald Trump deserves credit. I mean, I was a big skeptic of his, obviously, and I still am not a big fan of his, but I was skeptical that he would name the right justices, and he named three of the right justices. And not only that, but he stuck with them despite a lot of pressure, I think, especially with Kavanaugh. You know, someone like Mitt Romney would have probably have given up, right? So I think, and others as well, I don't want to pick on Mitt Romney alone, but
please do.
Yeah, Mitt's a coward now. So I think that those three people deserve a lot of credit, you know, just of how we got here, where this could happen. But it was weird because I was sitting here and I thought to myself, how, you know, the idea that abortion is a protected constitutional right is so wacky. It lacks any sort of moral, any sort of legal reasoning that is convincing at all. I mean, I was recently reading a book called Abuse of Discretion, which is about how Roe v. Wade happened. It's just based on pseudoscience and lies and just a made up concocted right. So, it's hard to even understand how we got here from that end of it. Do you know what I'm saying? Or why this could have ever happened in the first place. And that's how I think we should be looking at this and not, you know, and trying to ensure that it never happens again, that we don't have people legislating from the Supreme Court in this way. So, I mean, that's how we got here. And so now everything changes. Now it's a political battle. And I think that that's good for the country.
Yeah, I just got off taping the Friday morning show that I do for The Hill with Ryan Grimm. And we were talking, you know, Ryan's coming from the left on this, about how unwise it was for the sort of left-wing judicial movement to find this right to abortion, this right to marriage in the 14th Amendment right to privacy. And even people like Ruth Bader Ginsburg would look at Roe, Lawrence Tribe. I mean, there are tons of mm-hmm. liberal judicial scholars over the years who have said Roe is on shaky foundation. There's no way around it. When the decision was originally decided, people immediately said that. And the reason Alito in his decision walks through common law and Cook and Blackstone, goes through all of that, is because in order to find the right to abortion, the right to privacy, that's what Roe did. It also cited all of these common law thinkers. And it just never, like you say, it never made sense. It was always wacky. But then other decisions came along that also found the same thing. And Nancy Pelosi is sort of fear-mongering because Clarence Thomas in his decision said, in the opinion he wrote, said, we should also be in the future as a court thinking about the due process, where we find rights in the due process clause, et cetera, et cetera. And then there's all of this fear mongering that they're coming for Obergefell, they're coming for X, Y, and Z. And honestly, those things are vulnerable, not because there's political will in the country to do anything, but because the judicial foundation has always been shaky, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but I think that's right. And, you know, and I shouldn't have to be a lawyer, actually, to know what is a constitutional right and what is not. But I think all of that's right. And, you know, even with gay marriage, I mean, I think it would have been better. And I've always sort of been pro gay marriage, though not in the way that it's been foist on people. But, you know, having the courts do it is always problematic when you have a political situation working itself out in general. But moreover, I mean, you have states for a reason, so that if there's a socially conservative place that doesn't want that sort of thing, it shouldn't have to have it. And the same thing with abortion. So it just undermines the fabric of the nation, because you in essence pull away a philosophical, political, moral debate, and you just by fiat, you know, tell people what it's going to be, and you don't allow itself to work out. Whereas many other things we don't even think about anymore probably have been sort of worked out in the political process. But abortion was never allowed to do that. And now it will be. I mean, people always ask me, like, well, people always say, you know, Europe has stricter laws than we do on abortion, which is true. It's, I think, I don't think it's a good reason, actually, but it's the reason
the
is.
The author of the book Eurotrash.
Yeah. I don't think this is a great reason for why, meaning I don't think that it's a good reason for us to act that way. But the reason is that there's really no pro-life movement there. So they've sort of settled in and they don't need to be extremist on it because there's no pushback and, you know, owning the cons, you know, stuff like that. I mean, you just have much more extremism here on abortion than you do elsewhere. And I think that also fed into this. I think the pro-life movement has grown in ways since I was young. And I think it's because the left continues to take more and more extremist positions on it.
This is going to be, it may sound like a hard pivot, but it really isn't. There's this question of whether IVF is now on the table, whether Plan B is now on the table, because, again, there's a question of fertilization and implantation. And if you believe that life begins at conception, as the pro-life movement does and as pro-life legislators and voters around the country do, then yes, some of these things do have to be on the table because the bills will bring them up. And it seems to me, David, that even the industrialized concept of abortion that we have now, we have an abortion industry in this country, and it is a very, at this point, like a different process than it was in the past. It is technologically advanced. IVF is a fairly new technology. Some of these contraception methods that we're talking about are fairly new technologies. It seems to me that since the 1960s and since Roe, certainly, a lot of new technologies have been normalized and standardized in ways that we don't even think twice about, right? So it sounds really harsh that even IVF or Plan B would be on the table now in certain states. Do you expect certain states' laws in this question of, you know, fertilization and implantation to target intentionally or otherwise some of those new technologies? And if so, how do you think the pro-life movement will deal with that?
Yes, probably they will target them in certain states. And I think that it probably won't be very popular, right? And to do that. But I've always had this struggle with it myself because I don't really care if things are popular. If I think they're right, that sounds like so self-serving, but you know what I mean? Like,
also the author of the book, what's the anti-democracy book?
Yeah, people have spoken and they are wrong. As I've mentioned many times, did not sell very well for some reason. I don't really care, right? If it's right, I think you go for it. You make your arguments and you try to convince people. I have mixed feelings on those things myself, to be honest. So for me, I think the aim of the pro-life movement should be first, frankly, to stigmatize abortions that have anything to do with viable babies first, and then move towards other things. I think you would turn people off if you seem extremist. Now, if morally you believe those things are wrong, then you do what you have to do and say what you have to say. But for me, and I don't know how those work out politically, though I will say this, and I think that the left is overestimating how much Roe will help them in this political debate, because I think that most Americans do not have very, you know, are somewhere in the middle. And I think that they're going to now have to argue for bills that allow abortion until crowning, which is what Democrats support and what Democrats have voted for. And that's going to be just as hard as defending, say, a 6-week ban or a first, you know, or like a 13-week ban, which is what they have, I think, in Florida, which when you ask people specifically about is actually quite popular. So I think the debate, initially people won't understand it, but when things don't really change on the ground for, you know, months and years, I think the debate will settle into to something different.
I think the reason I ended up in journalism is that I'm just so skeptical of absolutely everything. It's like a reflex. And so when the good folks over at MyPillow offered to send some towels my way, I was immediately skeptical. I thought, there's so much hype here. Can they live up to it? Nothing beats the feel of a luxurious towel when you step out of the shower. And I'm telling you, this is not scripted right here. These really work. They're very, very absorbent. I got them in a nice blue color, so you can also wrap yourself in nothing but the best with the MyPillow towel set. Other towels feel good but don't absorb, or they absorb but they're scratchy and just don't feel good. Every MyPillow towel is made from proprietary technology that makes them highly absorbent and soft to the touch, but without that lotiony feel. Plus, with a 60-day money-back guarantee, you can try them for yourself and return them if you're not fully satisfied. Made with cotton grown here in the U.S. and available in a variety of colors, each towel set comes with two bath towels, two hand towels, and a washcloth two-pack. So for a limited time, get the MyPillow six-piece towel set, regularly $109.99, for only $39.99 with promo code Federalist. Visit MyPillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. You'll also find deep discounts on all MyPillow products, including the MyPillow mattress topper, MyPillow Giza dream sheets, and so much more. Get your six-piece MyPillow towel set for only $39.99 today at MyPillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. Visit MyPillow.com/Federalist today. I don't mean to sound like I took a bong rip before recording this episode, because I promise I didn't, but there's something going on with the transhumanism of these new technologies. And, you know, Andy Cohen recently, I really like Andy Cohen. He said that one day his children, who were conceived through IVF and born through surrogates, if they're unable to have kids, they can just, quote, dust off their siblings and raise them as themselves. Or I think he said de-thaw their siblings, defrost their siblings and raise them themselves. This is really dark. And I do think this question is now going to come front and center. Janet Yellen herself, in a paper for like Brookings in the late 90s, wrote about how abortion had actually increased single motherhood. You can actually draw a straight line from normalized, legalized abortion, the state laws that preceded Roe, and really this rise in single motherhood, because it changed the way people have sex. It changed the way people date. David, while abortion is going to remain legal in roughly half of the country, how big do you expect, or how consequential do you expect this overturning of Roe to be on these questions of family formation, on these questions of just the social lives of the American public, marriage and family? Will it be sweeping? Will it be as sweeping and consequential as Roe itself was, or because it's being turned back to the states and we have these sort of settled norms now? Will it, you know, not be quite as consequential as it initially was because it's being kicked to the states?
Damn, I don't know. It's a really deep question. I'm gonna have to read some books and get back to you. No, I mean, I don't think there's going to be any sweeping change, cultural, societal, or otherwise, off the bat, right? I mean, I don't know what the long-term consequences are. To this, I think that technology, we always have to keep in mind that technology does not stop for politics or for any other reason. So these things that you just mentioned will exist, and they will become more efficient and more and cheaper and more available to people. And someone right now is working on some new way to get an abortion that can circumvent any of these laws. That's for sure. So those are things we need to think about. And that's why initially I said, I think that in the end, you need to make arguments that moral arguments that stigmatize this practice and frame it as barbaric. Now, that's going to be hard, and it's going to take a long time, but that's how you win this in the end. But, you know, so I don't know the answer to that. I think you're right about single motherhood and so on. I think it's tied into a bunch of other issues, especially that sort of came to fruition in late 60s, early 70s, that have hurt society and made changed motherhood and changed families. You can't just, you know, fix that you know, in a year or two because the Supreme Court says something. It's something deeper than that. So there's two issues. One is procedural and legal, and the other is moral and cultural. And I think this, like I said, I think that second part is going to be a lot more difficult.
Well, and that's what I'm interested in. And as we sort of memorialize, eulogize Roe going forward, these really big questions, I think we're going to start to see them being worked out in public opinion and in, I guess, legally too, because you know, there's the Andrew Breitbart maxim that is sometimes misused, that politics is downstream of culture. Obviously true, but sometimes we forget then that culture is downstream of politics as well. And you know, Obergefell is one of the best examples of that. Public opinion was shifting in that direction for a long time. Obergefell comes down, and you know, the public basically is like, "Yep, okay." And so the way that we talk about these issues, I think, probably will change. And David, the reason I was glad actually when you raised your hand, I was like, "Are there any senior editors around to do an emergency podcast?" And David Harsanyi was the hand that went up virtually. And I was glad because you can kind of talk about how you came to be pro-life, right? Like for you, that was sort of an interesting, I don't know, like what's the best way to put it? Like ideological. Journey. Yeah, I was going to say quest.
yeah,
talk
I mean,
quest.
I wouldn't say I was ever pro-choice. I would say that I didn't really think about it very much and didn't care, which I assume is the position of like 90% of, not maybe not 90, but many, many Americans, especially because I'm an atheist. So I don't have a religion. There's no religious component to this. It's just for me, completely about logic and morality. I mean, you know, part of it was that one of my kids was born prematurely, and the idea that someone could have just disposed of that child at that time, you know, when she was born, is just horrifying to me. And when it was, you know, I don't like to personalize politics, but it just was the way it was. And then there was this other event that happened near my home when I lived in Denver, where a woman was hit by a hit and run driver. She was pregnant, killed the baby, and they, you know, charged the driver with manslaughter or even murder. I forget what it was. But the point is that you can't simply decide, you know, when it's convenient for you to decide something's living and something not. There has to be a definitive, you know, a definition of when life begins and when it doesn't. And the definition is pretty clear to me. Now, that doesn't mean I think that, you know, just because something, I don't think it's the same again, you know, when you're talking about a baby in its fourth month or, you know, first week. But I do think that a life is a life and we have to treat it like that. And then so from there, I sort of, you know, it became obvious to me that we were killing babies wholesale, and that most of those abortions were not, of course, to save the life of the mother or anything like that. It was abortions of convenience. Sometimes, in situations that are very tough that I could never experience, but that doesn't change the facts of what we're talking about. So, you know, I went from there and I tried to have debates over that with people, and they never want to have it. Like, they don't want to have a legal debate, because today you're going to hear a lot of people upset, but very few of them are going to give you any legal reasons for why they think Roe should exist. And they don't want to have the moral debate, because they'll just say it's my body. So it's very hard to have these debates. And that's why I think, or I should say, it's very hard for them, it seems to me, to have these debates. So I think that's why in the long run, the pro-life movement will not triumph completely, but will win the day.
Yeah. And there's this, I don't know, there's this idea. So Dave Portnoy tweeted, emergency press conference, we are going backwards, and lamented the overturning of Roe. We talked on this podcast a couple of times about the Barstool conservative coalition and how Trump sort of brought cultural anti-leftists into the fold, and, you know, Roe, overturning Roe and sort of putting the spotlight on the pro-life movement's affiliation with the Republican Party would be something that could turn those types of voters off. David, I hate that we have to have this conversation, but we probably do have to. It's a midterm year. Politics are very much involved, and that's going to affect the way that we talk about this. It's going to affect laws that are passed in various states as we go forward. What do you expect to see politically from this? Do you think the left, you mentioned this earlier, I agree with you, I don't think the left is going to benefit to the level that they think they are from this politically, but what's your take on how this affects the immediate political questions that are on the table in a midterm year?
I think it's going to be largely a wash. I mean, there are states, maybe Pennsylvania, let's say, where an issue like this might matter in a Senate race, you know, but it's the federal government is not going to make laws about abortion. So the media is going to run out and make sure to ask everyone, you know, what they think of, you know, abortion for those who are, you know, for in cases of incest and rape, et cetera, and try to make everyone seem radical or extremist on the right. But I just don't think most people are going to care very much about that, since it's not really going to matter in those races. Inflation is what they're thinking about, and, you know, gas prices, et cetera. I don't think that this is a topic that's going to matter very much, especially because it really won't affect many people. And in states where it will matter, let's say Texas, where, you know, you're going to have a stricter laws. I mean, Republicans have enough, you know, there that they don't need to worry about it. And the same thing when you're talking about a race in New York. So I don't think it will matter very much, but, you know, it's hard to tell, but I just think these midterms are already basically set as far as what's going to happen. Sorry.
Yeah, no, inflation is top of mind for everybody. This is a terrible economy. Abortion is rarely an issue that, if you look statistically, is what motivates people to vote in particular ways or to vote at all. That said, I think in one way, this could hurt the left in that, I don't know about you, I am expecting this to be I am expecting this to be a fairly violent immediate aftermath to the overturning of Roe. I think just in the lead up to the decision, we've seen, you know, a string of attacks, particularly on pregnancy centers, which, if people are unfamiliar, provide information, counseling for women who are considering or struggling economically or just mentally with a pregnancy, and sort of tries to steer them away from ending their baby's life. Those have been, you know, Molotov cocktailed. They've been vandalized and attacked in many different ways just before between the leak and the decision itself. And so I don't know, David, I think the more you put cameras in front of the Supreme Court, you know, Molly and I were there when the draft came out. It was the face of extremism. I mean, people just saying, like, abortion on demand now, no apologies, that kind of stuff. The face of the left activist base on this is extreme and very unappealing to the majority of Americans. I kind of think the more you have cameras on that, the less helpful it is to Democrats.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, this, you know, the myth is, of course, that the right is engages in political violence all the time. But we know, and most people know, that that's simply not true. It's never been true, not since I'm young, probably not since the 60s or earlier. It is the left that engages in violence. And I'm sure there's going to be some of that again. And it depends how bad it gets, obviously. I think there's two other factors to think about as well that could hurt Democrats. And I'm not positive about these things. I've just been thinking about them. One, of course, is that during these debates, they're going to have to explain their position, and they're going to have to say, or someone should ask them, and the media won't, so other candidates should, what restrictions do you believe in on abortion? And they will have none. So that will sound extreme to most people, especially when many candidates will say, we are just banning abortions in the first trimester. And the second thing that I've already seen happening, and I think Merrick Garland basically said this, is that they're going to try to nullify the decision and ignore the courts. That is insurrectionist. That is, you know, unconstitutional. And I think that that's going to come off as pretty extreme as well to a lot of people. I mean, I think there'll be an initial movement in the polls, and I think it's going to go back. I don't think Joe Biden, for instance, benefits from this at all, because he's such a unprincipled person who for 40 years was, you know, against abortion and just changed his mind, you know, one day when someone complained on Twitter. So I don't think that helps him. So, you know, again, I'm kind of working through it because it just happened, but I just don't think it's going to make that much of a difference in this midterm and certainly in the next presidential election. I mean, presidents, Republican presidents have been completely Donald Trump, whether he believed it or not, was the most pro-life president we've ever had. Probably maybe George Bush was as well, you know, tied with him. And yet it didn't, you know, he won the election. And I think people realize it doesn't matter what the president thinks on that.
Mm-hmm. And the media's coverage of this issue is just so incredibly terrible. There's going to be you've already been sort of looking at meltdown reactions, haven't you, David, as they've come in or just false statements and reactions to the ruling?
I look at it all, Emily. But yeah,
thank you for your service, David.
Yes, thank you. Listen, the media is corrupt. I don't mean that they're doing anything illegal. I just mean that they're corrupt in their stated cause. They no longer are out there representing the truth. They're not no longer just biased. They're activists. I don't mean every single person, but in general, I have no, you know, I don't think there's any hope for it for them anymore. And they're going to do what they do with every issue. They're going to lie. They're going to give us half truths. And they're going to say idiotic things, uneducated things that people who have taken a simple civics class will know are wrong. And
what are some of the big ones you think?
Well, there's this crazy. So basically, the left has tried to delegitimize the court forever because of this moment, right? They want to say that there are sexual abusers on the court and, you know, people shouldn't be there. And some of the reasons they give are that the presidents who nominated them did not have a majority of the popular vote, a non-existent thing that they made up, or that, you know, Donald Trump was put there, you know, somehow illegitimately, so the process isn't fair, or that McConnell undermined the process and did something unconstitutional by not sitting Merrick Garland. None of those things are true.
Well, they're already blaming Susan Sarandon. So my thoughts and prayers are with her today.
Yeah. I mean, Donald Trump was elected. He won the election. He nominated people using the prescribed constitutional method. And then the Senate did what they were supposed to do. This court is completely legitimate. They just don't, you know, they don't care about it. I believe, like, what is it called? I've been red-pilled, right? Like, I think that the Democrats want to destroy the Constitution. I don't think they believe in it. They've come up with alternative reasons, you know, having to do with majoritarian, you know, wins and stuff like that, where they want to centralize the government in a way that's un-American. They don't believe in the Constitution and they're trying to destroy it. They want to pack the courts. They want to get rid of the Senate. They want to undermine the 10th Amendment, the 14th Amendment, the First, the Second. So I no longer really, you can't really have debates with people who no longer share the same goals you have and just want to go about it differently. This is a completely, we're in a different realm now. And I think it bodes very poorly for the country. I've usually been pretty positive. I think, you know, I love America, obviously, and all the things that we do. And I think people and life gets better and better for most people in general. But politics is ruining that and dividing us in ways that we haven't been divided in a long time. So anyway, I think this will just, and the reaction to this will just, we'll see more of that. And it's going to get uglier and uglier. I don't know where it goes. And I don't know that there's any kind of politician out there who's going to bring us together or anything like that. I just think we're headed down into some ugly places.
You know, I feel like what we need right now is maybe some hope and maybe some change. Speaking of politicians, you can just unite the country. No, but really, they're actually, like, Susan Sarandon was trending on Twitter after the decision came out because of exactly what you just said, this idea that Donald Trump was the dividing line. And in a sense, of course, that's true. But without the, I think, extremes of the left and without Roe itself being terribly decided, you don't end up here. It's really not Susan Sarandon. It's not, she's not the thin line between Roe and post-Roe.
It's weird. I'm sorry to interrupt. It's just weird. No, I think 9/11 sort of brought us together. Now, you were probably very young when that happened, but, like, I feel like for a very brief moment, we're all like, you know, we love this country and all these, you know, et cetera. But then that started falling apart. And I think then Obama came and it started falling apart a little more. He could have. That was a moment that could have helped the country. Now, I'm not a big unity guy because I think in freedom, unity undermines freedom. We're supposed to be able to live together. We don't have to agree on things. And then I think
Obamacare, that's a unity in a sense.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's a unity in a sense. But you know what I mean? Like, their unity really just means agree with us and do what we want. But then, you know, I think it's weird, and people, you know, I've been kind of criticized when I wrote this, but I think Obamacare is really the moment. It's never one single moment, but that's a good just touchstone moment for where one side decided without any consensus that it was just going to stuff something down everyone's throat, without any real debate, without any consensus to change the way we did something. And that changed politics, I think, for maybe not forever, but for a very long time. From that moment on, there wasn't going to be much real bipartisan agreement on reforms for the nation, things like that. And then after that, Barack Obama and Harry Reid and others started making the argument that simply because Republicans wouldn't do what they wanted, they had the right to act as, using executive power, blowing up things like the filibuster, like they got to change the norms. And that made people very angry. And that's why I think we got Donald Trump in the end. And, you know, the rest is no recent history. But so I really go back to Obamacare when things started falling apart in this way.
You know, I've been thinking about this recently because, I don't know, there's a Hollywood newsletter that comes out. This may sound silly, but was sort of, it'll lament, you know, the excesses of political correctness in the industry, but then lamented what it sees as a reactionary swing in Hollywood as people whose careers have been railroaded are, you know, come back with friendly receptions and, you know, people are getting more comfortable speaking out against political correctness, et cetera, et cetera. So it's interesting to me that people call it a vibe shift. I think there is a vibe shift afoot. Whether or not it's durable is another question. It's interesting to me that Roe sort of comes into the middle of this. I feel like if anything, other than, of course, the incredible, you know, the most important thing is the amount of human life that will be saved because of this. And I also think it presents a wonderful opportunity for the pro-life side to make these arguments in ways that haven't maybe existed in the past. I don't know. Do you get that sense that maybe this creates fertile ground for planting these seeds of pro-life messaging and these seeds of just like pure science and information? I think it was through you I started reading what Christopher Hitchens believed about abortion. Naomi Wolf, of all people, had a very good piece in the New Republic in the 90s about how the left at its own peril ignores the realities of abortion and should embrace the reality and be honest about what's happening when an abortion procedure takes place. I don't know. Do you get the sense also that this may really present fertile ground in a powerful way to revisit some of these important arguments?
Well, so let me go back to Trump. Obviously, again, I always have to reiterate, and I feel like this is throat clearing, but that I do not like Donald Trump in general. I just don't like the way he behaves. It doesn't mean I didn't like a lot of things he did. And one of the
things you're obsessed with him, David.
Well, one of the things he did that wasn't political, but I think he gave people some spine. It's like they'd say to him, you know, you did this, you know, and you know, whatever X. And usually like Bush or someone would be like, well, you know, I didn't exactly mean it that way. And, you know, it's going to be fine, you know, but Bush, you know, Trump would be like, yeah, you know, I did order the code red, damn you, whatever that line is, you know. And so he, you know, people are far less inclined to make excuses for the things they believe or try to, you know, mitigate the effect of what they want to do. As you mentioned, you know, people at the RNC, you know, it's like catching the tiger by the tail thing, you know, you oh my God, now it really is overturned, or, you know, now gun rights, you know, are real and we can bear arms, etc. I think that a lot of people are just braver now and speak out more the way the left has no problem doing. Now let's take this to a personal level. If I go out somewhere and there are a bunch of leftists, they never feel like that they need to contain themselves when they talk about politics, right? They're always just, you know, they say whatever they want. This is just my personal experience. But I'm always like, I don't want to like cause an argument or upset people. But so that's how Republicans used to act in politics as well. And now they don't, you know? So I'll give you a quick example, just since the gun rights decision came down as well, is that people talk about Heller, and Heller is one of my favorite decisions. It affirmed the individual right to gun ownership in the home. The NRA was against that suit initially in its early stages. It did not want to participate in it because it thought, first of all, that would be bad politically, but secondly, that it would allow the court to strike down the individual right. They were scared to go for it. It took a bunch of like libertarian lawyers who didn't even have guns to push that forward. So I feel there was a lot of that in the 90s and then 2000s and things like that. But Trump changed that dynamic quite a bit where people sometimes they say crazy stuff, I have to admit. But, you know, in general, they are not, you know, shy about giving their opinion or shy. You know, they act like the left acts. And I think that's why Trump is so hated by the left, because he was, I think we spoke about this, I think one of the more moderate Republican presidents in recent, you know, history. But anyway, so that's just a rant on something. I went a little off topic. I don't even remember your question.
That is such an evergreen statement. That was just a rant on something. I don't remember what.
Just ranting. I'm all worked up. I don't know what's going on. You know, a lot going on this week. And I'm like, what am I going to write about? It's funny. I finished a piece and I like pushed the button to send it exactly as Sean Davis, who we work with, said Dobbs is released. And I'm like, oh, no one's going to read this.
I know. I had a whole monologue on Title IX ready for Rising this morning, and I had to do it after the decision came out, like 10 minutes after. And I was like, this is pointless the entire time I was reading it. There's so much.
Morning.
It really, truly. But there's so much like fear mongering already afoot, women's health. I don't know if you saw Nancy Pelosi's comments. I'm sure the president's comments, which happened as we were taping this, were equally fear mongering in his messaging to the American public. But legalized abortion, the advances in birth control technology, all these things really changed the way that people saw sex, and this idea that sex is, you have a right to have sex and then not carry a baby or not parent a child. And that's obviously not true. And to find that in the 14th Amendment is also bizarre. But David, going forward, I guess I'm just wondering where you see the Republican Party in terms of like as this fear mongering comes down and it hits Republicans hard, and a lot of Republicans probably in Washington, D.C. aren't eager or super willing to defend the overturning of Roe. How do you expect the Republican Party to react to this intense fear-mongering campaign from the left and, frankly, from the legacy media?
I think some will say correctly that, this doesn't ban abortion. It only gives it to the states. And, so it's not as big a deal as you think it is, and try to diminish how important it is. But others, I think, will see that in their states, especially in red states, there are a lot of social conservatives who are against abortion and who want to limit it in many ways. And I just am kind of confused why people talk about places like Florida, which has a very, I think, moderate limitation on abortion. I think, again, 13 weeks or even 6 weeks, I think most people would think was enough. I mean, you mentioned, how it changed motherhood and things like that. And I think I was thinking about this while you were speaking. I just think it is devastating, has devastated many families and our future in many ways to think that people will use abortion as contraception, basically. And that's what happens. But also when talking about that, I think we always have to mention, and a lot of times online, you'll see someone say, oh, if men had to, care for those babies, Republicans would never support it. No, I'm not a Republican really, but I 100% support coming up with laws that ensure that when these babies are born, that the men who participated in making them also bear responsibility for raising them and for taking care of them. I think that that's important as well. There's nothing, and I think you mentioned this too, but to me at least, there's nothing creepier than these pro-abortion obsessed men who it's clear to me, and maybe some of them are Barstool guys, I don't know, who are clearly wanted around because, they're selfish basically. And so I think it's important to talk about the men as well and not just lay all the responsibility on the women.
Yeah, no, and that is a fantastic point. I think it gets to the earlier conversation we had about the fertile ground, the vibe shift, the ways that Republicans are now probably willing and able to defend the pro-life position with a sense of confidence that may not have been there in the past, but maybe that's wishful thinking.
Yeah, I mean, younger men are probably, I don't have polls in front of me, but I assume they're more pro-abortion than men who are married, just the same way as women who are married probably are far more pro-life, right, than single women, I imagine. But we didn't talk about this either, but I think especially considering, again, that I'm older and that I remember that abortion at some point became very tied into the idea of women's rights and feminism. And so many young women grew up thinking that those things had, you know, were tethered and had to be together as they move forward, saying, you know, that they were feminists, I don't know enough about the history of this, but it seemed to me like it's just this political stance that people don't really think through completely. And I bet you there are a lot of folks out there who never thought about the issue, especially younger, as deeply as they might have to now that it's going to become sort of central to a political debate, not just dueling protest in front of the court, but an actual time where you're going to have to make legislation and so on.
And I'll just say they're having to rethink that. I think that's absolutely true. It's going to put the issue in people's minds and ask them or demand of them some additional thought. And they're being asked to rethink about it, to question perhaps these reflexes at a time where we have people saying that, you know, their kids can, quote, defrost their siblings and raise them themselves. And at a time when abortion pills are being sent in mass, and women are having, you know, some genuinely terrible experiences with them, and at a point where ultrasound technology has advanced, viability technology has advanced to the point where very premature babies are able to live and be full human beings. I do think that's
I love to share stories about, and I think it's 21 weeks now is the is the youngest baby that survived, and that is a time where you can get abortions in number of states. I mean, when I was in Colorado, there was a doctor who came in from Nebraska, I think once a month, and performed really, really late term abortions. And people pretend that that's something that never happens. Oh, it's only 2%. Yeah, it's 10,000 or around 10,000. Babies we're talking about every year. I mean, if I told you that 10,000 babies were being shot in schools or something, it would be a really big deal, even if it's 1% of all murders. I mean, that's irrelevant. And the way they diminish that as part of the news story, as part of their, you know, coverage and stuff like that, it's really just awful. So I think that there are a lot of good and strong and honest, truthful and moral arguments for the pro-life side to make in this debate.
Absolutely. Well, David Harsanyi, thank you so much for joining the Emergency Podcast here at the last minute and for all your thoughts. I actually think your next book should be on abortion. I'm not your publicist. Maybe I should be, but...
Well, I actually tried to write a book once about, I'm sorry to prolong this thing, but no. I wanted to write a book about sort of the secular case for against, you know, for life. Mm-hmm. And but they told me that no one would buy that book, so
don't do it. Well, if you're a publisher out there and you want to, you know, buy that, you think people will buy it?
It could be a slim volume. Write it quickly.
It's just like the David Harsanyi version of Common Sense.
Yeah,
I like it.
Should be a string of books like that.
I'm all for it. I'm all for it. Make it happen, David Harsanyi, senior editor at The Federalist. Always appreciate it.
Thank you.
What a wonderful day. What wonderful news to come from the Supreme Court. I want to thank all of our listeners. As always, I know a lot of you, though, have been out there fighting the good fights, not just in the trenches and the official pro-life movement or out here in D.C., but also in your communities and with your family and your friends and your own personal decisions. So just grateful to everyone that's been a part of this. You've been listening to another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at The Federalist. We'll be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.
I heard the faint voice of reason.